here.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Chair, I would move that we approve the Rout County check sheet for July 15th, 2019, accounts payable, check cycle date July 6th through July 12th, in the amount of $1,349,580.48.
Second. Do we have items of note, Tom?
I do, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Have a payment to Alpine Aggregates LLC. This is a road and bridge budget. This is their spot gravel purchasing, and this is for districts 1 and 3 in the amount of $16,913. We have our quarterly payment to the Steamboat Springs Chamber Resort Association for economic development services that they provide. This is for the third quarter of 2019. And this is out of our community services budget. Payment's $15,000. Payment to Correctional Healthcare Management. This is from the Sheriff's Adult Detention Budget. And this is the monthly inmate medical services for August of 2019, $11,538.98. I have a payment to Kilgore Companies. This is another payment from the Road and Bridge Spot Gravel Budget. And this is for works for District 3 on County Road 62. Payment of $4,796.86. Have a payment to GMCO Corp. This is for road and bridge for death suppressant. Various county roads, gravel roads, of course, $120,296.22. Payment to Straight Stripe Painting, Inc. and or Dixie Clean. Road and bridge budget, this is asphalt road name marking, $118,429.75. Have a payment to Smyzer Gordon Meyer Inc. These are engineering services, bridge design of five minor structures under the road and bridge infrastructure budget, $5,700. Payment to Wagner Equipment. This is from the heavy equipment pool. Purchase of a low boy trailer, $73,109.11. And payment to XBIX, it's XYBIX Systems.
Zybix, I believe.
Zybix?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
That's what Jason has said when he comes in.
Yeah, it confused me when they put it on in caps.
Yeah.
But that makes sense. It's comp center pool and one dispatcher workstation, $23,331.91. Payment to IMS Infrastructure and Management Services. This is from the Road and Bridge budget. This is the Infrastructure and Management Service and then assessment of paved roads. Then payment to Morpho USA Inc. This is from our equipment pool for the sheriff, and this is for the APHIS Live Scan Maintenance System, $7,592.
All right. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thanks. Let me see where the heck we are here. So yesterday we had updates from the county manager, from legal, the Public Works Department, accounting, CSU Extension, human resources, and the assessor's annual Board of Equalization report.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve consent agenda item A.
Second. Other discussion? And I don't know if we wanted to note specifically for the record that correction that we made in the minutes regarding item 6K and that it was actually 6E. So probably just should note that. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Public comment.
Okay. Do I have?
You sit right here with us.
Well, you need the other.
Yeah.
Recording.
Can I just sit here?
Well, we have to have you on the recording.
Sorry.
But thank you.
Not a problem.
will be very nice.
I'd rather be shot in the foot than public speak. But
I understand. I
feel it's just us.
On this one.
It's just us.
Okay.
I'm Matt Mountain.
Okay. Luana Yockbettle.
Nice to meet you.
Tim Morgan.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
You can just go ahead and let us know.
Okay. Just to give you, my family owns and operates Saddleback Ranch. My grandmother came to this valley when she was 8 years old and on a stagecoach. We've been ranching the valley ever since 1903, and our hearts are here. I've lived in this valley and loved this valley for 69 years, and I hate what the county is letting happen with the weeds. It makes me sick to my stomach. And anybody in this room, looking around the Steamboat area, Whitetop, didn't make them sick to their stomach, then they don't love this valley as much as I love this valley. And I refuse to sit idly by any longer. My son and my husband both told me, Mom, you have no filter. I am not going to have a filter on this one. I refuse to have a filter because the weeds, in general, are destroying this valley for its beauty. And I'm sick to death of it. And it's got to change. It's not maybe we'll do this, maybe it needs to change. And it needs to change now. You know? Rowell County says we have a weed management deal. Driving the county roads when the wind's blowing the spray right back into your truck and you feel like you're doing your job, you're not doing your job. My stepdad, Buster Moore, in the 70s, sprayed weeds. And him and one other guy sprayed weeds, and we didn't have 1/100 of the weeds that we have right now. But when they saw weeds encroaching on someone's property, they called him up on the phone and said, Mr. So-and-so, can we come in and spray the weeds? And the weeds were kept under control then. And this whole thing is the weed control. I was out spraying bull thistles the other day, and I thought, the letter I got, I got it last Monday, telling me that I could spray Whitetop. I've been fighting Whitetop from the day we could get into the pastures. I'm not a good public speaker, but darn it, Saddleback Ranch spends anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000 a year fighting the weeds, and our neighbors don't have to. There's something wrong there. There's something really, really, really wrong there. And these letters that say, be a good neighbor and maybe you'll be penalized. No, penalize them. Send someone in to do it and then send them a bill. That's a pretty simple fix, I think. And I'm just a dumb old cowgirl, but when you get my ire up, I can be everyone's worst nightmare because this valley is getting destroyed by weeds.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of questions. I've heard two different things from you. I heard some dissatisfaction with how our employees spray for weeds in the right of way. Is that correct?
Okay. I talked to Ray and Greg. We had a conference call the other day. They told me that they used to have 5 sprayers out there. Now they have 3. That's what they told me.
I don't know when it was 5, but anyway.
Okay. Well, that's what
I know. We have 3. So.
You know, my thought is, if the barn's on fire and the firemen show up with their big hoses and everything, you don't take the hoses away from them and say, well, here's a squirt gun, fight this fire. This is a fire. This is an absolute fire in this valley.
Okay, so I'm hearing that you don't believe that Rowell County's doing a good enough job of spraying the weeds in the right of way. So I'm sure County Manager Solomon will pass on that comment to our weed supervisor, and we will certainly get regular updates. We will have a conversation with Greg about that particular complaint.
But they need to go beyond spraying 6 or 8 feet out. My gosh, do tourists come to this valley and say, I didn't see a weed along that county road for 6 or 8 feet, but past there, it's everywhere.
On people's private property.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the other thing I heard you say, some dissatisfaction that you don't believe some of our property owners are doing a good enough job of controlling their own weeds.
That's true, but they need to have the pressure put on them. All these newcomers, and I'm talking newcomers, that either are being part-time owners or whatever, they could care less. They absolutely could care less. And the pressure has to be put on them.
So I definitely hear that, it's an ongoing issue for us.
But you don't pull the funding away from this program.
So
it's time to get in.
We haven't.
So
I don't care if it's aerial spraying.
I would dispute that we've actually pulled funding away from the weed program. But I hear your concern that we're not spending as much as we should.
Absolutely.
Years
ago, the county didn't have the revenue that it has now.
Yeah, and then the last thing that comment I would make would be. Have you engaged with our weed board at all?
I will be there this time. I sit idly back and I refuse to do it.
I think that's a really productive thing that you can do is be proactive with our weed board. I think we listen to our weed board when they make recommendations. And I think it's a thorny issue when we do talk about imposing weed control on private property. We do, in fact, have to get a court order in order to do that.
They didn't used to.
Yeah, it's state laws.
But now, whatever it used to be, but nowadays, we cannot enter someone's property without a court order. And I will agree with you that that makes it really tough for us to act. I mean, it's tough. We don't really like imposing court orders on people. We do send out the letters. We would like to think that we could get some voluntary compliance by virtue of those. If we talk to Greg, we feel like we've had some success, but I'm hearing, especially with this year's whitetop outbreak, it may not be enough. So we hear you.
Okay, I hope you do. I honestly, truly hope everyone sitting in this room listens to me. I'm mad.
And you know what?
People don't want to see me mad.
And you know what? That's perfectly okay. And thank you for coming.
Well, yeah. Okay, another thing is we did not do as good a job on the whitetop as we usually do because the weather, the wind, we had springs coming up out of the ground that I'd never seen before, and I've lived on that ranch all my life pretty much. And so we couldn't get tractors in there. And so for years and years and years, we hired Wayne Tucker out of Craig, came up, he flew for us. Last time he flew for us was last year. He said, I will not spray in Route County for you in Route County anymore because he said, I spray along your state land, the county road runs all the way through our property, and these bikers called him up and called him everything but a white person because he was spraying our weeds and they were bothered by it, you know. And so he says he won't spray for us again. And that's a dirty, rotten shame because there's parts on that feeds down into the county road that someone in our family is going to get killed with trying to spray those last weeds. And an 8,000 acre ranch, you can't backpack spray it. I don't care who you are. If you had the army out here, you could not backpack spray our ranch.
Well, we need to move on to our next agenda item. Thank you very much for your comments. And by the way, you're actually a pretty good public speaker.
No, I think you
did a great job. You did a great job. And we definitely heard you.
I hope someone listens because I'm not stopping you. On whatever I have to do.
That's good.
And my son has the idea, you take some of this revenue off of pot sales and you put it in killing the weeds in this county, the noxious weeds. Not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea.
You know?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
What about
Tim?
What about
Tim? She liked
him.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
All right.
Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome.
Come on up.
Did you get that part where she said I'm doing a good job in the record?
Okay. We normally don't put that in the
record.
I'm going to have to announce there's have a word with Lane.
All right. So I guess we're officially hearing the fee in lieu fund distribution.
Correct.
Okay.
And
go ahead. Ready? Yes, right. Thank you.
And this is the hearing to award those funds that the county has collected for fee in lieu. The letter stating that these funds were available were sent to all of the school districts, including the Northrop Charter School, and we did get requests from all three districts for the funds that are available in their areas. And those funds are $23,327 for South Route, $182,162 for the Steamboat area, and $6,514 for the Hayden area. And the Hayden School District requested the funds for playground equipment for the new K-12 school. Steamboat Springs District requested those funds for security upgrades, communication equipment, and purchase of a property for a future school. And then South Route requested the money to help fund repairs of several paved areas at facilities that they're in their district. So those are the requests, and I don't have anything else.
Perhaps for the record, maybe a quick description of the source of these funds.
So these funds were collected through subdivision applications, and they are meant to help offset the impacts to the school districts that subdivisions create and the additional residential development that those subdivisions create as well.
And the requirement was that they be utilized for capital funds.
Correct.
And that they benefit the areas of the subdivisions, correct?
That was, I don't know if it goes, if the state statute specifically goes into that detail, but that is what was included in the letter to the school district stating that these funds were available.
I read, thank you, their request letters, and the only question I had was regarding the Steamboat Springs request. Because they didn't clearly lay out, and we were pretty specific in our conversations prior to this that we wanted to see a benefit to North Route, that it not just be to Steamboat, and I don't see in their letter that they've outlined that. Did we get any other information from them about
what was included? Was the only thing that we received.
So I think you could make the case. I mean, the North Route Charter School is part of the Steamboat Springs School District, and many of these improvements that the Steamboat Springs School District is suggesting could indirectly benefit, especially when you look at the 800 megahertz radios for safety and security, would certainly be beneficial to the North Route Charter School.
And one thing I would like to add is that the charter school goes through eighth grade, so all the students that are in North Route mm-hmm. High School come to Steamboat, the Steamboat Springs High School, so they're another possible benefit to the residents of North Route.
I think you could definitely make the argument. I'm not saying that I don't see the benefit, but given, maybe I know too much, but given my understanding of the relationship between the school district and the charter school, I would probably have preferred to see some support from North Route Charter School in order to indicate that. So I don't know if we could request that.
Well, you know, I think certainly I don't think that this is time critical in terms of the school. We could potentially approve the request from Hayden and Sirocco and table the request from Steamboat and ask for some clarification on the benefit to the North Route Charter School.
I mean, even just an indication of support from the charter school, whether it's from the board or from the principal, I think would satisfy my questions about that.
I think you've raised a legitimate issue, and they may very well be able to come back and provide justification based upon what they have here along the lines of what I mentioned and what Alan mentioned, but I don't think it's unfair to ask them to address that directly.
Because there is the just limited information when, you know, having that thought in mind when I read the letter from RE2, you know, that it's from the district and North Rock Community Charter School. And in the first bullet, it's security items to reinforce entrances at all schools. Second bullet, Wi-Fi in all buildings. And then, Commissioner Gargan, you mentioned the 800 megahertz radios. So
I think
they
could easily make a statement about that.
Sure.
I would like to see that direct connection. I mean, I appreciated that Dr. Sinner, you know, took the time to indicate how the Hayden School District is specifically benefiting the Milner area, and I would have liked to see similar, even whether it's a statement from them or even just a statement of support from the charter school themselves.
Okay. So, do you want me? Is that the kind of motion you're looking for? Is to approve Sirocco and Hayden and table the request from the Steamboat Springs School District?
That's what I would like to do.
Okay.
Are you okay with that? Is there anything else that you need us?
So
I see that you're here, Eric. Is there anything that you would like us to put on the record?
No, I think your rationale behind your request or direction is that the majority of the subdivisions occurred in North Broward.
Yes. Yes,
within
correct.
The RE2 subdivision or RE2 school district.
Yes.
All right, then I think we're going to need two motions, and I'll make them both. The first motion I would make, Madam Chair, I would move to authorize the distribution of $23,327 to the RE3 Sirocco School District and $6,514 to the RE1 Hayden School District of funds collected through the subdivision process.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Madam Chair, I would move to table the request from the Steamboat Springs School District in the amount of $182,162 to a future date to be determined, with the specific request that the Steamboat Springs School District provide some justification for the how they're going to be spending this money and helping satisfy our concern about the amount that should be distributed in North Round.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I will contact three districts and give them the updates.
And what's the status of the discussion around revising some of the way that fee in lieu is collected? Do we have a timeline on that?
Timeline? No, there's no date set for that. We were in the process of collecting examples from other municipalities or local governments, counties.
Okay.
And I think that's the only thing that we're waiting on. We have some of that information now. But I think Eric brought up Boulder County, and I think there's another example that I had looked at that was in Englewood. It was maybe similar to that, but that's at the other end of the spectrum.
Okay. But, so you'll be bringing us back some options to consider on that?
Yes, we will. All right.
Great.
We'll look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Go
ahead. I, acting as chair, move that the Board of County Commissioners go into executive session to discuss PDR grant funding for 2019. This executive session is being electronically recorded, but minutes of the meeting will not be produced. This is an executive session for the following purpose: to discuss the purchase, acquisition, lease, transfer, or sale of real personal or other property interest under CRS Section 24-6-402-4 A, I caution each participant to confine all discussion to the stated purpose of the executive session and that no formal action may occur in the executive session. If at any point in the executive session any participant believes the discussion is going outside the proper scope of the executive session, please interrupt the discussion and make an objection. It is July 16th, 2019, and the time is 11:28 a.m.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
They all need to reply, you know, by May 1st or whatever. And that's
for tier, the tier two compliance dates.
Let me do this one first.
Well, we need to come out of executive session first. So the time is now 12:16 p.m. and the executive session has been concluded. The following persons were present at this executive session. Commissioner Tim Corrigan, Commissioner Beth Melton, Claire, what's your last name?
Sollers.
Claire Sollers, thank you. Thank you. I know your name. Left me for a minute. County Manager Tom Sullivan, Deputy County Manager Dan Weinheimer, and Helena Taylor. The board limited its discussion to the purpose stated in the motion to go into executive session, and no formal action was taken.
So, Madam Chair, I would move that we grant extensions of Tier 1 approval and funding of
Tier 2.
I'm sorry, Tier 2 funding for projects 188, 191, 192, 193, 194, and 195.
And do we need to say the recommendation requires that the applicant, that piece needs to be in the motion as well, right? That second part.
Requiring that the applicants comply with one of the following measures by May 1st, 2020, completion of all Tier 2 requirements, or submitting an amended application.
Second. Other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Madam Chair, I would move that we approve Tier 1 funding for Project 196 in the amount of $450,000 plus transaction costs of $25,000.
Yeah.
Yes.
Why don't we do that, and I'll do a second motion for the other one.
Great. Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
In terms of Project 197, do I need to stipulate any of the requirements that we were talking about in terms of limiting the PDR percentage?
Correct.
Refresh my memory. We're going to.
I think it's that paragraph. It's in that one paragraph of that letter. This.
We had the 197
portion. So.
No, I never did.
But I don't know how we want to.
There it is.
With the condition.
Locked in at 48.7%. I think I can do it. Okay, Madam Chair, I would move that we approve Tier 1 funding for PDR project number 197 in the amount of $775,000 plus $25,000 of transaction costs, with the stipulation that PDR funds for the conservation easement purchase are locked into a maximum of either 48.7% or $775,000, whichever is less.
Depending upon the final appraisal.
Depending upon final appraisal.
And that includes the $25,000 transaction cost.
I included that in the beginning of the motion.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Great.
Thank you very much. So we will convene as the Route County Board of Health. We have Carrie Ladreau, our public health director, and what's your name? Scott Kalman. Director.
Environmental health director.
Yes. Tell us what we're talking about.
So we have a few things. I was shaking up the format a little bit as to what we usually do.
Oh, no. Really?
Okay. I know you're disappointed.
Huh?
But
okay.
I don't like it when we shake things up around here.
But I thought what we could do is just start with this checklist I had mentioned last time from the National Association Local Board of Health. And just, I wanted to ask you a few questions about the oversight part and just our relationship and what you would like from our relationship, your relationship with me, and then also obviously Dan and Tom and Scott as well. But a couple of the things that they ask on this checklist, and I thought we could literally check off the checklist, and then we will know how we're performing as a collective group for the Board of Health. And so the first one is maintaining a good relationship with the health director and health officer in a culture of mutual trust to ensure that public health rules are administered and enforced appropriately. And my question on that one was, do you feel like you have all the information for the Board of Health, what the Board of Health is supposed to be in charge of, what the assignments for the Board of Health are, what you're tasked with? Do you feel like that information has been clearly presented, or is there more information I could get for you to review?
I think there's always more to be understood about the public health rules and what we're responsible for, is what I've gathered over the past few months. I mean, I think, you know, you're doing a good job getting, all of you are doing a good job getting us that information, but it just, it's a little bit baffling sometimes how much there is. So I just think there's going to always be more to understand about it.
So I found it's been helpful to go back and look at those handouts that we've gotten from CDPHE about public health. And so is that all of the information that we need? Well, it's very helpful in terms of that global understanding of what our responsibilities are, but in terms of specifically, you know, how we interact with you and the information we need to localize our understanding of those responsibilities, we could use some more help with that.
Okay, okay. Because the National Association of Local Boards of Health has a lot of great articles, and I just thought if there's something that I can share as it comes along with you, I would like to do that.
So our habit as commissioners has been, yes, send us the information. We know how to use the delete button when we're just too busy to deal with things, but it doesn't bother us to have that information coming through. Okay. I mean, use some discretion, don't you?
Right, right. Oh, no. I want it to be helpful. I just wanted to kind of gauge, because I am having this conversation with the Moffitt Board of Health as well, just about what areas do they feel like they need to have more information on. So that's helpful.
I think understanding legal responsibilities is probably the biggest place that I just don't, and it sounds like I just don't totally know or get it. And it's, I think part of the reason is because it's been a little muddied how all that has worked. And so clarifying that, you know, when what rises to the level of being a public health emergency and needs to be communicated publicly, and whose responsibility is that? And, you know, and in, I think before it was always, well, we don't worry about that. And so I think probably there's an increase in just awareness of asking those types of questions, and that will be ongoing to understand some of that.
So, you know, we can continue to provide information, and I guess I'm not sure as far as the rules are for the Board of County Commissioners versus Board of Health, but it seems like maybe we have a little bit more flexibility with Board of Health in terms of meeting together and talking about stuff. And
No,
it's the same.
It's the same requirements as the Board of County Commissioners.
No, we have flexibility to the extent we could meet more often. Than
you could if you want to. Sure.
So I guess I don't know what you're referring to. Yeah.
Well, like, let's go sit down in a conference room and.
Well, we can do that sort of stuff anytime we want. It just has to be publicly noticed. That's really all.
So I guess my question would then be, we can continue to provide you with this information, but what more can we do, if anything, besides this meeting and providing information that might help?
So are we scheduling Carrie for monthly updates?
Carrie has monthly updates as a department head, and then the Board of Health, I mean, statutorily, the quarterly is a requirement, the minimum requirement.
So I think the idea that we're going to be getting monthly updates from Carrie is expanding upon what we've done in the past significantly.
Right? Yeah.
And that's a good point, because that's probably a good time to talk about these things. And certainly I can join Carrie if she wants me to, if depending on what we're talking about. I'm certainly willing to.
You have your time each month, too.
So. Yeah.
Right.
I think that what is happening is great. I just am aware that there will be more that we need to understand.
Sure.
And I think, you know, to the point of the difference between Monday update from a department head and Tuesday where we have a recorded Board of Health meeting, I mean, we can make sure that we provide more public information in these types of meetings, you know, that's consumable by you, but also hopefully informative to the general public as well. Mm-hmm. So maybe just change the focus a little bit, you know, in terms of, you know, a monthly update is more operational and in nature, trying to provide some direction, and you know, the quarterly could be more informational to the broader public about the programs and you know, information on them.
Yep. Okay.
So you understand that our Monday work session, the updates you'll be doing on a monthly basis would be during our Monday work session time that is not recorded and not broadcast to the public.
And I did one of those, so I feel like I have a sense of those. Right. But if there are things that you want me to bring that I'm not or anything like that, just let me know. I'm happy to bring one of the other questions on here is obviously hiring and regularly evaluating the performance of the health director. So that's a new addition we can check off at the county. And then also acting as a go-between for the public health agency and elected officials when appropriate. So that's a follow-up question that I have. Is my go-to Dan, just on logistics, to have conversations with others? Is that sort of the setup? Because it's a little different in Moffitt County. So I'm just trying to gauge, like, what is the communication
they don't have
pattern?
They don't have I mean, you report to Dan. There's
so
no
I talk to Dan, and then he conveys the information that needs to be, like, for our recent situation. That's, okay.
And that's the same with me.
It's too technical. Yep. You'll have
And I think, you know, you're anything that you want to give information to us directly mm-hmm. or that you want feedback from us directly, it would be during that Monday work session.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, yes.
Okay, great.
I mean, the interesting thing is that, and Scott knows this with me at least, is that if I'm curious about something, I come running down the stairs and ask him, mm-hmm. help me understand this. Mm-hmm. And I may very well do the same thing with you, mm-hmm. just so long as you make sure that you report those conversations to your superior.
Mm-hmm. Just remember the front door for that office is locked, so
need. You have to go to the window first. Request for a planner of the day first.
You can always borrow my key, though.
And make sure that you don't allow me or any other commissioner to provide direction to you. That's mm-hmm. not our role. I try to, when I go down and talk to Scott, I'd like to think I'm down there asking for information. Mm-hmm. I suppose from time to time I stray over the edge a little bit and say, I think you ought to do this. I'm pretty good. I try to be good about it.
So. I think the only place it moves in that direction more, like, is if we have, like, something from a member of the public that we're conveying to a department head, but
right.
Okay. It's not meant to be outside of the county management. It's just expediting.
Okay. The next section on our new revised format is resource stewardship. So I thought I would check in on
what?
Resource stewardship. So I wanted to kind of update you on, for the contracts that we have, what I'm doing and kind of give you a sense of the public health department role right now and what it looks like. So immunizations, we are contracting with Northwest Colorado Health back out.
In the process of executing
that agreement.
Did they get a new refrigerator or what?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Is that going to be a short term or is it?
That's for the year.
1 year, okay.
And then as far as communicable disease, I am working with Kate Lujan, who is the CDPHA. You met Kate. Mm-hmm. And we're handling the animal bites that come in and any communicable diseases together because I haven't previously been, I mean, I've known about them, but I haven't been the person actually investigating. And so we're tag teaming the communicable disease outbreaks and sort of she's giving instruction as to what needs to happen as far as the boots on the ground for communicable diseases. So that's the case for Moffitt and for Rock County.
And prior, we were handling most of that, and we probably shouldn't have been. And so it's been helpful to have...
For
animal bites,
not
I'm sorry.
Animal.
So it's been helpful already to have Carrie involved. and to get, and we do usually call Kate when it happens. So I feel better about that process, and we still are coordinating if there needs to be, if the specimen needs to be decapitated, and then coordinating the courier. And,
you so. Personally do that, or like in your office?
No, we request okay. help from a veterinarian.
Okay,
and that makes more sense. And as of yet, we haven't got charged, but that's something that maybe we need to put in our budget as a little bit of money to pay for some
services. I'm glad I now have a better understanding of that particular action.
So yeah. Essentially, when there is a risk for rabies exposure, then it's post-exposure prophylaxis, but it's the PEP treatment. You have to make sure it is obtained in a timely manner. And so essentially public health needs to be making the recommendation for PEP for the individual out in the community. And previously, I think that was punted over to environmental health a little bit. And so
then we were like, we don't do that.
Right. So just delineating, you know, this is a public health function, the medical side right. of this bite, and then handling the decapitation
logistics.
Logistics of that is on the environmental health side. So
what's the purpose of decapitation? To ensure that the animals
the lab won't accept a whole specimen, and they have to test the brain.
Okay.
And so with the bat, they'll accept. You don't have to decapitate a bat. But
I am learning so much about public health right now.
If it is a raccoon or a skunk, which are sort of our more typical, or a dog, then we can only send that part of the specimen to the lab.
Sure, it saves shipping costs, if nothing else, right?
Narrows it down to the brain. Where's the brain? Oh, yeah.
Oh my God.
And then to date, I don't know if we've ever had a skunk. I know that on the Front Range, it's fairly common that they'll do, you know, a dozen or two, like I know in El Paso County. But this was, I think, an odd situation.
You wouldn't give any detail on that.
But anyway,
there
so
was
this
situation.
Is the first time that we've had to deal with a skunk.
Just recently.
So, as far as communicable disease, one thing I did want to just note is if there were to be an occasion where there is a situation in both counties, and there's one of me, and so I'm assuming that our arrangement with CDPHE is that people would come from CDPHE to support us, and so I just want to kind of
so have
talk about that.
Question of ignorance or forgetfulness. Have we, as the Board of Public Health, been receiving statistics from our previous provider in terms of numbers of rabies cases or numbers of...
We review that during... We have that CIDR team, and so we get from the regional epidemiologist, we get all of those numbers. The rabies cases, we get the any particular communicable disease outbreaks.
But we haven't. But those numbers have not been reported directly to us, the Board of Public Health, I don't believe.
I don't
recall.
And today, I don't think we've ever had a positive, since I've been here anyway, a positive case.
Of rabies?
Yeah.
How about hantavirus?
Since I've been here, I don't recall.
I know that there have been some in the past, but I'm thinking of years in the past.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that something that we should receive? Well, and that was one thing that I was going to talk about is we can do an aggregated. You just have to be careful with the N being so small. But we can do an aggregate of cases and share. Me, myself, and I guess. But I'm happy to share that with.
Yeah, I mean, if there were three cases of humans that had contracted rabies, we would want to know about that. And then, but do you guys also track the number of animals that have tested positive?
Yeah.
Yeah, we want to know that. Yeah. Why wouldn't we want to know that?
Yes, all of this, any kind of communicable disease is tracked very closely.
What are some other examples beyond rabies and hantavirus that might be common?
I mean, pertussis. If there's a pertussis outbreak, that's just an example.
Measles.
But like, yeah, measles. West Nile, obviously, is one that has been a headline.
Do you have to decapitate the mosquitoes?
I'm sure you saw in the newspaper for Moffitt County, there was a mosquito in Moffitt County that tested positive for West Nile. It was on the lower range, but it did test positive. And so West Nile is obviously something that we want to continue to educate. But that's a little bit of an update on communicable disease and just kind of how we're handling it. And then as far as child fatality, I wasn't sure how familiar you are with child fatality reviews, but if a child passes away in the community, there's a team that comes together to review what happened and then just also try to prevent it.
Is that on a local basis or on a – there's also a state.
There's a state, and for investigations or where there are criminal charges pending, the team from Denver will come and support the local team. But if it's more of like an accident type of situation where there aren't any pending charges, then it'll be the local team. So we'll continue to do
so
that.
So any child fatality gets investigated or reviewed by this local team?
Right.
Regardless of circumstances?
And yes, and so I facilitate those meetings. So as hopefully we won't have any, but just so you know, that's something that we're prepared to do here at the county level.
How frequently do we have to do that? I mean, I assume it happens.
It does happen. Right? Yeah.
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 It does happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even a child that, say, may have died of some kind of a terminal disease in Denver?
So there's a case description that the children meet. So if it was an anticipated death with a likely cause, then we wouldn't review it. But interestingly, just as an example from one of the recent child fatality reviews, the prevention piece got to be really important, and we were able to identify some programs in the community that could support some prevention mechanisms, and so a lot of good came out of a really sad situation, and so it's a great team. So that's child fatality. As far as CHAPS and the planning,
I'm sorry, do we appoint people to that team? Is that part of our appointments?
It depends. Well, it depends on what the circumstances of the case are. Usually, if for example, in a recent case, we would have fire, police, child advocacy groups, Department of Human Services. It kind of depends on the different cases.
There's
so
not
that's
a standing
not a,
team?
Yeah.
There's a standing mandated partners list, and then you can also accompany that with other people who might be appropriate for the case.
Yeah, because you're right. I don't recall us making an appointment to them.
Yeah.
So who does? They come from the standing list. Is it your responsibility to go out and grab those individuals?
Yep. And then also we do a pretty extensive documentation request when there has been a fatality in order to have all the documentation to review.
But that squarely lands in your wheelhouse. Yeah. You're the responsible person for ensuring that happens. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I just learned something new about public health.
Yeah. Great. See, I told you, there's always more.
Okay, so then moving on to CHAPS. I understand that Dan gave a little snippet of the funding opportunity that's available starting October 1st.
I don't remember this.
Okay.
We talked about the grant,
last week.
Planning grant that we applied for with Moffitt. So that's what she's talking about. It
that sounds
had
familiar.
Been more of yep. a discretionary or
one of,
a formula
one of
grant.
Of grants.
Yeah.
So I can give you a little more detail on that, just that it can be used for salary. I checked with them. I know that was one of the questions that came up was, can it be used for salary rather than just programming or some other? And so, yes, it can be, absolutely, and that's traditionally what people have used it for. So we applied for $25,000 for Route and $25,000 for Moffitt for this grant, and we'll know by next Friday how much we were.
So can this money be used for implementation of the Public Health Improvement Plan?
Yes.
That's part of CHAPS.
Exactly. Okay. And the partnership, what they're really trying to push for with public health transformation is partnerships between local public health agencies. And this money is really trying to support those partnerships. And so that was really a strong suit of our grant application, that we are newly partnering and we have a lot of opportunities. So for that one, I just wanted to give you a little more detail on that.
As long as we're talking about CHAPS, when do we start again?
It's a 5-year cycle.
When did this cycle start?
It seemed like this last one took about 5 years to do.
I think we were a couple years behind, not quite 5 years.
It was 2012 to 2016.
Yeah.
And so it's...
So we have two more years before we do it again.
No,
we're doing it now. We have a gap in between. You know, we should have had them meet and have that 5-year and next 5-year.
But okay.
A couple-year gap. And so we're in the process there of finishing the CHAPS, which then is Public Health Improvement Plan. So we take that information and do something with it.
So, Mike, so...
So 2025.
Thank you.
Sorry. Yes, that.
So that ties in, actually, I'll skip to...
Yeah, and then, so 2025 is when we need to complete mm-hmm. our next CHAPS. When would we start that process?
Well, 2020, we would probably start having some conversations. But let me tell you that I'm hearing through the grapevine that they're going to be changing the CHAPS process as part of public health transformation. So we may be looking...
That seems like a good idea.
Well, given how it's going. I guess the frustration for someone like with me is, as soon as we finish one, we're supposed to start the next one?
I mean, yes.
Well,
we should be implementing.
I'm talking about going through the whole planning.
Yeah,
the planning isn't a five-year process. The implementation of the plan is a five-year process. So the planning should be a basic one-year process or less, and then 5 years for implementation. We just are behind on getting
the plan. We've just gotten through, and have we even seen the results?
I have an update on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've just gotten through with the planning process, which felt like it took 5 years.
I don't know that we're actually all the way through it, but yeah, we're pretty close.
Pretty close to 5 years. Yeah. So what I'm hearing from you guys is that the planning process should not take 5 years.
No.
It should only take a year.
Or less.
But you would confirm Tim's suspicion that it did take 5 years this time.
I don't think it took 5 years. I think it felt like it took 5 years. I think it took longer
than it should have.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's been a shorter than...
Well, I'm pretty sure I went to a meeting in Hayden like maybe 4 years ago.
No, I haven't been here 4 years, and you and I went to that meeting together.
Okay.
It just felt like 4 years.
Felt like 4 years.
So what
it was like you've been here forever. No, I went to a meeting before you were here.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, with Vicki Clark.
So I have an update on that while we're at this. I met with the Northwest Colorado Health Partnership is an entity that I feel like I've been kind of disconnected from, but there's some opportunities for parallel work or connection or something there. So I had lunch.
We feel the same way.
You do? Great. So,
well, we don't know about the opportunities part, but that we have no idea what the heck they're doing.
So I went to lunch with Stephanie.
Yeah, I know Stephanie.
Great. And me too. One of the things we talked about was we collectively would like to have some better alignment with this CHAPS process, with their community health assessment process, with what they're driving. And so the long story
short, their community health assessment?
That community health assessment. I think you took the survey that went out.
So that's, I guess, part of the source of our frustration and misunderstanding. They are performing their own process that's similar to CHAPS?
Through the hospital transformation project.
And that's not part of CDPHE.
I don't know who generates the hospital transformation.
I would certainly hope that CDPHE wouldn't be driving two separate community health assessment processes.
I think that's separate, but the idea is she has collected a lot of data through their survey that they did, and then there's also this simultaneous project happening with CHAPS. Like, how can we pull all of this together and use that data? And so I think moving forward, there's a lot more opportunity for this to run smoother than it did historically. And so a couple of the strategies that Jacob, who has been initiating the CHAPS process, wanted me to ask you about is, do you feel like some type of a resource guide would be a tangible outcome of the CHAPS process and a strategy coming out of that? Is that something you hear from people? Is that something that you feel would benefit the community?
There's not already a resource guide in existence somewhere?
There are a lot of them, but as soon as you publish it, it's obsolete. So what mm-hmm. the conversation has been is more of an online resource or something that can be updated more organically rather than publishing it and having it be obsolete.
So more to the point would be, and I think we all share this frustration, and we've talked about this before, mm-hmm. is that we have all these organizations out there planning. We don't have, it doesn't seem like we got too many organizations implementing. And so I just wonder about the Northwest Colorado or the Health Partnership. Mm-hmm. Are they a planning and data gathering organization, or are they a service provider?
They do both. They have direct service provision as well.
So I guess the question I would have, mm-hmm. are they gathering data that we've been unable to through the CHAPS process? Are they gathering different data? Or are they kind of gathering the same data? And maybe they can be convinced to spend less time data gathering and more time providing services or vice versa.
Right.
Maybe you know, maybe we should be doing more and let them do the data gathering. I don't know.
What we were thinking, Stephanie and I were thinking, is literally take all the information that we get from Jacob once he's done with his work groups and sit down and look through the public health improvement plan process and see where we can align what they're doing with what the county needs to do for the CHOPS process or for the public health improvement plan.
As long as we get some kind of decent balance between studying problems and addressing problems.
I totally agree. Yeah.
And if you can accomplish that with the health partnership, that's a great thing.
Okay. Yeah, that's the idea behind aligning some of this work together.
So your question was about a resource guide.
Yes.
And my initial reaction to the idea of a resource guide, I mean, you heard me say already, isn't there already a resource guide? And maybe it's just because I'm adept at finding things, but it's hard for me to see that as a really impactful strategy. It feels like the kind of thing that somebody would do it, and then in 5 years, they'd be like, let us point to this concrete thing that we accomplished in public health. But my question would be, what are the outcomes of that that we would expect? Mm-hmm. And so I think you heard us both express, Doug was conveniently absent the last time we had a Board of Health meeting, that I want to see the outcome measures.
Right.
And I know that that's not always easy to do in public health when you're talking about these really big things, right, where it's like, are we going to see enough of an impact that we have data on, you know, that shows that? But I'd rather see some effort to measure actual outcomes on people than just, well, now a resource guide exists, so we're going to pat ourselves on the back that we made sure that a resource guide existed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I would ask a resource guide to what, for whom?
So I think that's where the devil's in the detail of, you know, what was discussed. I mean, I think to a certain degree that's more of a tactic than an action, you know, item. It's more, you know, trying to address, I think, the mental health focus area for CHOPS, you know, is one of the two areas, and making sure that people who are in crisis, you know, we talked about it in the sense of the crisis services and this change that we've been having or are about to undergo, I guess, you know, sort of trying to figure out how that would work, and then some of the other service providers that are really, like the health partnership, that aren't really well known. You may be able to measure increased use of those services based on the resource guide, you know, just assuming that there is more knowledge out there that these providers are providing services, that there are not maybe duplicating services because they know other people are. I mean, that might be a pipe dream, but there are needs out there for referrals and for, you know, a layperson to maybe refer someone in crisis to a provider and that sort of thing. And so, I mean, I'm with you. I understand where you're coming from, but I think you may actually be able to measure a resource guide.
Well, I think exactly to your point is what I'm trying to say, that it's maybe a strategy to what end. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, that's reflective a little bit of what you're saying, too. I mean, who is it for and why do we think it's valuable? Mm-hmm. I mean, do we believe that there's an issue with people being able to identify the services that they need and that some kind of a resource guide would help to bridge that gap? And if so, then what outcome can we measure to demonstrate that it's been valuable? Mm-hmm. And if that's not the right strategy, then what is? Mm-hmm. You know, do we think the mental health issues are due to there being services that are available that people don't know about, or there just not being services available that people need? And I would argue it's probably a little bit of both, honestly. And so I would be really, really reticent to just take the easier, less expensive version of trying to address these problems if we don't actually think it's going to have an impact. Mm-hmm. However, if we do believe that it would have an impact, then I would be supportive of doing it and would want to know what that impact was.
I'm curious. I mean, I'm just thinking about a resource guide. Is this a pamphlet that we're going to leave around town?
No, it would be online.
The online part of that. The pamphlet is the problem in a lot of ways. It's stale as soon as you print it, where an online resource wouldn't be, presumably. still requires updating and all those things, but it could be more organic.
So is the expectation we would have this online resource guide would be available to those individuals that are in a mental health crisis, and they're going to go, oh, I'm in a mental health crisis. I wonder what resources are available to me. Is that realistic?
No, I think it was what I was trying to say is that, you know, when someone's in crisis, a person, a provider they may be in contact with or a family member would be able to go to that place and be able to help them,
okay,
rather than assuming the person in crisis would,
okay,
find it.
That helps me understand that better, but I would echo Commissioner Melton's comments about.
So I think that
if it's really being utilized and we're really getting people to the resources they need, presuming that they exist in the first place.
So, I mean, it sounds like this question came from Jacob for feedback, and I think the feedback I would give is that if, you know, there should be a demonstration that this strategy is going to address what the actual problem is, because mental health is not a definition of a problem in and of itself. You know, are we talking about substance abuse? Are we talking about suicide rates? Are we talking about access to mental health services? I mean, what is the actual problem that we're trying to address with this? And I think a clear demonstration that this addresses the problem we're trying to address and that there are some outcomes and that it's a tactic, not a goal in and of itself.
And so I think as far as where, and correct me if you heard something different, Dan, but where Northwest Colorado Health is going to take the CHAPS project to, it's the identification of the strategies, and then I'm taking over the public health improvement plan writing and implementation.
That's probably pretty fair. I think we plan on taking it over in earnest in September and driving to that improvement plan.
Mm-hmm. So if that's the strategy that's being recommended by Northwest Colorado Health, then probably a narrative or whatever about why this is the right strategy and, you know, exactly what problem it's aligned with.
Mm-hmm. Is that the update we're about to hear?
That you're about to hear this? That was the update, except for community connectedness was the other strategy that he wanted me to bring to you.
No.
About
the CHAPS process,
mm-hmm,
having been brought to a conclusion?
It isn't at a conclusion yet.
But I mean, I'm addressing this incorrectly. I guess,
okay,
I've envisioned this. CHAPS ends, public health improvement plan begins. Or is it a continuum?
There's an actual document, the public health improvement plan, that will be written from the CHAPS process.
Written from the CHAPS process.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And
so, but has the CHAPS, Northwest Colorado Health's work in producing the CHAPS, have they completed their work?
No.
And when?
September. The end of September,
so just
is the end.
Forgive
date.
Me, but I do recall sitting in a room here with Jacob hearing that we were going to receive that at the end of June, I believe.
Yep.
That has turned out not to be true.
A bit of a slide.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I hadn't missed something.
Remember when we took his boss and hired her over here?
So another strategy that was discussed were ways to connect outlying members to develop a sense of community. So that
I read that in some. He sent something.
Okay.
Yeah, he sent an email.
Yeah, I remember seeing it, and I was very confused by that one.
Repeat it.
So I would sorry. Go ahead.
Please repeat that.
Tim needs
ways
to
connect outlying members to develop a sense of community.
And this is part of CHAPS?
Yes. Well, a strategy.
So I'm still confused here. I apologize. Am I thinking incorrectly that you're already talking about implementing part of the CHAPS process?
Jacob is requesting our input on the inclusion of these strategies in the CHAPS.
And keep in mind, they're supposed to be addressing mental health or physical security or safety. You know, and so those being the overarching strategies. The community connectedness, I think, came in, again, on mental health in the concept that there is a fair amount of isolation, you know, just even geographic isolation in the county. And so trying to build more social capital in the communities, you know, that more connectedness hopefully equals more access to resources, more, you know, less of a crisis, more of a, you know, an ability for people to engage one another. And, you know, it's not it's probably hard to measure, right? You know, the idea of like having more events or more social gatherings may improve the connectedness, which may lessen crisis.
Well, and one of the barriers that was identified was childcare for people participating in those events, mm-hmm. and so they talked about the Gus the Bus program,
yeah,
the mobile preschool childcare.
I've really got to apologize, and I think I've got too much going on in my life right now, and too many different things that are happening. I don't feel like my brain is firing on all cylinders.
This is also very confusing.
Okay, but again, Jacob is requesting our feedback on this particular issue or some issues in order to complete the CHAPS process? Or is this something separate from CHAPS?
This is all part of CHAPS.
This is all part of CHAPS. And part of our previous discussions were that the Board of Health would weigh in on the strategies.
Prior to the completion of
exactly.
That. Okay.
So this is
so we are
weighing now at that juncture.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Not so sure.
Sort of. Perhaps.
We're almost there.
It's our fault that this isn't done.
No,
I get
not
it.
At all.
This is your opportunity to weigh in.
Okay.
Great. I'm with you now.
I have some comments about community connectedness.
I appreciate it. All right.
If you take enough time, this might satisfy the requirement of your input for the next 5 years.
Okay.
Yes.
Community connectedness is not a strategy.
It's
that's
not a what?
A strategy. That's my first commentary.
Yeah.
Like, just calling community connectedness a strategy doesn't make any sense to me. And I'll just be, you'll be nice when you tell Jacob these things.
Right.
But I also really question the use of the terminology around outlying communities or
outlying members.
I mean, do we have reason to believe? My assumption is that means people outside of Steamboat Springs. I don't know if that's what he means or not. Do we have reason to believe that mental health is more of an issue for people who do not live in Steamboat Springs?
I don't think it was a degree thing if there's more or less. I think it was the idea that if resources are centered in Steamboat Springs,
right.
then there would be an issue of accessing them.
I guess I would just question whether we have information to support. That's the concern versus something else.
I agree with you. I think a lot of this is predicated on the data collection and driven by data, so I'm assuming there is some data, but I don't have that.
Well, that
I don't know if our experience has backed that up.
Yeah, because that survey had there were some discrepancies, I think, in the categories of the survey that went out.
Right.
And then I think the other thing, just anecdotally, mm-hmm. which I know there's been lots of information gathered and whatever else, but this idea about events, social events. It has been my observation that in this community, the majority of social interaction occurs with substance use. And so if that's not part of that conversation about mental health, it seems like a missed opportunity. If the idea is just we're going to try to bring people together more often,
mm-hmm.
we're going to try to make sure that people have opportunities to connect with one another, have social interactions, whatever, and you don't address that, I think you're really missing out on where some of the challenges are probably coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Just in my experience, and even comparing to other places I've lived, it's pretty significant,
mm-hmm.
I think.
So I'm going to push back a little bit. You said that you didn't consider community connectedness a strategy.
Correct. And I do not consider it a strategy.
Wouldn't it qualify as a strategy? I mean, there's certainly all kinds of evidence that individuals that lead isolated, disconnected lives have all kinds of mental health and physical health issues. So a strategy to connect those individuals in a community way would be a strategy to improve their mental and physical health.
I could support that. I think it's more, you need to write it in a way that sounds like a strategy.
Right.
Like community
and
connectedness is like a dream.
The strategy
right?
needs to be a little bit more specific.
Right.
Yeah. Like
what you said.
The goal is community connectivity.
No, the goal is improved physical and mental health that could be enhanced by these community connections.
But I think if it's going to be a strategy, it needs to be written in a way, you know, like identifying individuals who are isolated from the community and you know.
I thought that's what happy hour was.
Connecting them with resources. Well, that's exactly my point. That's exactly my point, is that people are usually drinking when they're engaged in social interaction in this community, and I would be very surprised if that wasn't contributing to mental health and substance abuse issues.
So maybe drug and alcohol-free community connections.
And maybe that is. Maybe that's a strategy that needs to be considered. Creating opportunities for people to interact without substances.
And you see examples of that around here, and maybe it's just because I'm around here, but the Thursday night bike ride and the group that gets together from the Methodist Church.
Which is more prevalent in the city of Steamboat Springs than it is in our outlying communities.
Right. And I don't know that for sure because But, you know, there'll be more opportunities now in a place like Oak Creek because they have a trail system.
Not yet.
Well, but that's where it connects back to some of these things, you know, opportunities in some of these areas and why, you know, I'm so supportive of that project in particular.
But I think it needs, in my opinion, to be more of an actual strategy. And maybe that was just a rough draft form, but community connectedness, in my mind, is, okay, we've identified, we think there's a challenge with that, and there needs to be an actual strategy that comes from it.
The other issue, I think, with this process is I don't think environmental health has been there aren't going to be strategies around environmental health, and that's something that's tangible and measurable as far as whether we want to do air quality or whatever. I feel like that would be almost like a something that people would resonate with, people that they could see marked improvement with or some kind of difference, and there would be ways to measure it.
Physical safety, there's certainly opportunity for environmental health there.
Yeah, so I would like to bring the feedback back as well to incorporate environmental health components to this too, because I think that would make sense. Yeah, okay.
And, you know, we, through this transformation process, we're looking at our core services, and I bring that up a lot. These are our core services, but I'm not sure that we do a very good job in making that connection with the core services, so that's something else that maybe we should talk about and maybe try to convey to folks at the state that seems logical that should be addressed.
Yep. Okay, anything else about CHAPS? I will give him that feedback.
I think one of the other things that we brought up, I'm just looking at the meeting notes as we were having this conversation, that it's my suggestion, so I'll put it out there as a caveat, but this is just my suggestion, is essentially the cluster-based approach to public health and, you know, creating, you know, a list or some resource guide is helpful, but then also having meetings with providers in a certain group may help with that alignment and gap analysis around some of those issues in the community. I think there was a lot of conversation in our group about the providers' availability and some of the technical hurdles of being a provider for people who maybe have less ability to pay for services, all those things. So, you know, just trying to identify some of those barriers and then work through them is probably a decent strategy, but I think the way you do it is to put people in the same room.
And then, sorry, go ahead. That brings me to the next conversation, which is Dr. Harrington, because...
I'm sorry.
Yes.
I have to back up for a minute.
Oh, sure.
So, regarding the CHAPS process, this is, Will Rock County's public health improvement plan look generally similar to Moffitt County's, or will there be significant differences? Because it's been just one CHAPS process, right, for Rock and Moffitt together?
Well, actually Jackson as well.
Jackson as well. Mm-hmm. But so are we just going to be producing one joint public health improvement plan, or will there be a different one for Rock County and one for Moffitt and one for...
It's going to, well, Jackson now is on their own as far as producing the public health improvement plan.
Okay.
I'm not involved
right.
in
That's
that.
Right.
And then, secondly, it's going to depend on which strategies are selected for each county, because if they're similar, we are hearing some similarities in Moffitt County. So there is the potential that there could be breakaways breakaway sections which are different, and then some common
element. One public health improvement plan with different addendums.
Right,
focused.
Right, and I think we had that conversation sometime in the past about how we wanted that to look like, and there was agreement on...
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
I would just say one other thing, and I still feel obviously a little fuzziness about this CHAPS public health improvement plan, mm-hmm. and what's in which part and mm-hmm. whatever, so I don't know when this comes in, but if we're really talking about mental health, I think from the county perspective, the interaction with the criminal justice system really should be considered in terms of just talking about strategies, whatever those are, but it seems obvious that our jail is mm-hmm. dealing with a lot of mental health
Absolutely.
Kinds of issues, and that it costs money, right? Mm-hmm. But it also, it creates this revolving door for people. Mm-hmm. And so if we're talking about public health, I think we need to also be talking about that and wherever that belongs in mm-hmm. the process.
And what about human services?
I would imagine the same thing yeah. in human services. Yeah, that's...
But interestingly, mental health as a subject is not expressed as a central responsibility of the public health.
It's been identified as a public health concern in our community.
But when we talk about the, like when I go back to the information I've received from CDPHE that's helped me get a global understanding of public health, mental health doesn't actually really appear in there, does it?
You're talking about the core public health services?
Yeah.
Not currently, but with the public health transformation, there'll be mental health woven into the core public health services because it's been identified essentially that impacts all of those other.
Yeah, it seems crazy that it's not. But I'm just pointing out that it hasn't been shown that way.
Absolutely, in that diagram, it is not shown.
But moving forward, mm-hmm. we should expect that that's going to be a central focus of your work.
It's a recognized
part of the pie, one of the slices of the pie.
Yeah, and it's access to healthcare, access to mental health treatment, access to, that's one of the roles of public health, it's not the provision of. Yeah.
Okay.
And then the only other thing I would just, you've heard it, but I'll just reiterate it. I think we want to see evidence of outcome measures. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's so easy within public health. An unfortunate thing that happens is our goal was to survey the community, and we did, and we achieved our goal. Like, let's pat ourselves on the back. And I think I would like for us to be able to demonstrate that we're at least trying to measure the impact we're having. And I know it's hard to demonstrate often, but if we're not even trying, there's no way we're going to demonstrate it.
It was like when that story I tell about rural philanthropy days. Steve and I went and we sat through 2 days of stuff, and one of the primary goals that came out is that the goal was to collaborate. And I was just outraged. I was just flabbergasted and outraged. Really? That's the goal? To collaborate. Towards what purpose? That's not a goal.
Are you familiar with or involved in conversations about that Thriving Well dashboard that has the data?
It's been sent to me a bunch of times, and I've never understood what it has to do with
Yeah,
but I understand that they're trying to accomplish something like what I'm talking about.
That's the only reason I was asking about
it. And that's through the partnership,
it is.
Is it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay.
And I think that's where, just to tie this up in a bow, maybe the 25,000 grant application can come in, is you know, really better strategies, better tools mm-hmm. for us, and more alignment with, you know, especially if we're working with MOFIT as closely as we plan to.
Yep. That makes sense.
By the way, I found out of my community service block grant tripartite board meeting that I'm going to be required to go to a full one-day training session for Roma results-oriented. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Measurement? Is it the M in measurement?
Assessment?
Management and accountability.
That's it. Results-oriented management accountability. Maybe I'll learn something there.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah.
Tell us what you learned.
You could join for the day.
I'm okay. Thanks. You just let me know how it goes.
The other opportunity that has arisen as a result of some of the recent situation is that I have developed a great relationship with Dr. Harrington, very involved. He's very responsive. He's been really so supportive, and that's awesome. And it has bled into the opportunity for us to also use him as the medical officer for Moffitt County, for both counties. And that's very exciting, because then that way I can have one person as far as medical advisement and the Board of Health can for Moffitt and for Route. And so he is going through the contract right now with Moffitt County. It's been drafted. And so that would be, I feel like that would be a huge win for our region to have him provide those services for both counties.
And he's been doing this for free?
In Route County, I believe. Unless
yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And he's going to do it for free in Moffitt County?
They'll offer a stipend. Yeah.
So shouldn't we ultimately be in the position of providing some kind of a stipend for him?
That's a decision above my pay.
I mean, just because he has we at least need to be prepared for
that. Frankly, I think it's appropriate.
Yes.
That we provide something.
Yes. Yeah.
Seems like it would make sense.
Do you have any idea what they're going to be?
$100,000?
Shut up. That's not a stipend.
it's an
hourly rate up to $500 per month that they're offering.
So do you think that there's a way to find room within our budget to provide that same kind of stipend?
Once we have a better handle on our budget, yeah.
Okay.
And is public health producing a budget? I mean, that's a...
So on the just logistical side of things, especially with an outbreak situation, if we were to have one, it doesn't matter where Moffitt County stops and Rock County picks up. And so having one unilateral medical advisement, I think, is great. So that's,
I do.
I'm really excited about that.
Did they have a previous health or medical officer?
There has been an absence.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is our agreement with Dr. Harrington up to date? I know that we...
Is there a formal agreement with Dr. Harrington?
We did have a formal agreement. I'm trying to remember.
I can't recall. I thought he had asked some follow-up questions, so I'm not sure if it got executed or not, to be honest.
I'll follow up on that.
Include that.
Would his agreement not have been with Northwest Colorado Health?
No, it was with the county.
It was with us.
Yeah.
Should be with the Board of Health, yes.
And the public health agency.
I think that's on our list of appointments.
Well, the public health agency
is it not?
Doesn't have the authority.
I feel like I remember it being on a list of appointments.
I suppose an agreement came through that we ran through on the consent agenda at one time or another.
Yeah, I just can't remember what the status of that is. So I
can't
get with Carrie, and we'll make sure that that's...
Yeah, yeah. Cross the T's.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, our interactions with Dr. Harrington, as he's come to a number of the quarterly updates when Northwest Colorado Health was performing that role, was always very impressed with his presentations.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it seems like
it's great.
The right guy?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's all I have on my list of things, unless you have other questions for me.
No, I think, through a slow and steady process, as Beth and I both mentioned today, seems like we're learning something new every time you come here, so that's good. And beginning to feel like I'm getting a foundation to work off of.
Great.
To understand public health.
Great. How are things going for you? It's been busy.
Yeah.
And I also feel like that this is... definitely an improvement over what we had going before. So.
I will second that sentiment.
You feel like things are moving in the right direction?
I absolutely do.
Yeah,
I absolutely do.
Good. Yeah.
So just to clarify, too, the immunizations, we need to complete the agreement there with Northwest Colorado Health. That's the only core service at this time that they would perform for us. The remainder are going to be performed by Carrie. And then I believe we still need to work out the agreement, the MOU between Moffitt and, or the IGA between Moffitt and Route. So that, I think, got a reminder from the county attorney in Moffitt to...
She asked me this morning.
Yeah, to move that along. what we had talked about was waiting a month and sort of trying to let figure out at least a little bit of the process of how it actually is working. One of the things we are doing from an accounting standpoint is tracking hours for each program by county. So any hours that she's spending on programs, sort of exhaustively is in a spreadsheet. That way we are likely, I think we would sort of still honor that 60-40 intention in terms of the split of agreement, but I think likely we'll also end up being much more to the penny of actual time spent, and that may help us long term. So when we write that MOU or IGA between the counties, we'll probably look to say the intention is this, but the reality is we will bill what we know is time spent.
I hope I've made myself clear through the years how much I believe tracking people's time is really an important thing to do. So.
Well, especially for the federal grants and arguably any of these grant programs, you want to be able to be as responsive and have all that information provided as accurately as possible. And since the state is wanting to do cost assessments and all these transformation-related data gathering exercises, it's going to be helpful for us too.
Well, it's just good. Keeping track of your time is a good, is a good habit to be in.
It also keeps us out of trouble.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you evaluate your program? Unless doing this cost analysis,
you do a good job of that
for on-site wastewater. Yeah. How do we know?
Yeah.
Unless you're tracking the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
For sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think I'm ready.
Okay.
Well, we can back up and start over if we need to. As required, do we have all these on?
Yep.
Okay. As required by statute, the Board of County Commissioners is sitting today as the County Board of Equalization. We are ready to hear the appeal for schedule number R8163996. The first order of business is the swearing in of the petitioner. Got it. So that only that's what's on here. Not
and
the assessor.
For the record, the petitioner is not present.
The petitioner is not present. I'm reminding the representative from the assessor's office that they're still under oath, but you're saying they're not under oath yet.
We
need to do
that. Sworn in.
Okay, so we need to swear in the representative from the assessor's office.
And who would that be?
Susan Sixon and myself.
Gary Peterson. This would be the same,
yep.
Right? Okay. So do you swear that the testimony you are about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
Yes.
Yes.
Great.
Yep. You get
so do I read this before you make your statement?
Yes. I think it's wise to read that into the record.
If you read it now, it'll cover everything that's going forward, too.
I would say wait till we're just doing the stipulation.
Okay, so just make a statement regarding the stipulation, and then we can...
You may end up having to read it in for the next one.
Yeah, that will be fine. I can do that.
Okay.
Go ahead,
so
Susan.
The petitioner is not here because we reached an agreement yesterday on the value after considering his location on his street compared to the comparables that I did have, and it resulted in a slight land value reduction, and he was agreeable to my adjusted value, so that's it.
Pray tell, what was the adjusted value?
So his original valuation was $623,040.
Yep.
And the stipulated value is $593,040.
So no action is required by the Board of Equalization in this case at this time. Is that correct?
Don't we need to go ahead and make a motion to that would?
No, because really this
goes back to assessor's level.
It says on my form, we will forward the acknowledgement to the County Board of Equalization in order to cancel your scheduled CBO hearing.
Okay, so we don't.
Yeah, okay. We're just informing you as the board that we've come to an agreement. On it. Because you guys have not made a decision on this yet. I mean, it's been appealed to you, but I still feel like it's in
Yeah, because typically,
court. as the assessor if we can.
Well, and you said that this is canceling the hearing. So we're just not, having this hearing.
And it says, by consenting to the adjusted value or classification, your rights to further your 2019 appeal are concluded.
Okay.
If the petitioner was still here, then a motion would need to be made to either uphold the assessor's value or to grant the applicant's petitioner's revised value or some other number.
I think at that point we'd be having a hearing.
Yes.
Typically these things get canceled and removed from the record. I'm not sure why this one did not get.
Because it just happened yesterday.
Okay. Yeah, so some of these come in late.
Okay.
And so we're just notifying you that we've come to a stipulation on it, and a hearing will not be held.
Okay.
Well, great.
Sounds good. That one's easy.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
The next is scheduled at 2:15, I believe. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, but this is an equalization, so there is no petitioner
involved. So we're okay to hear it early.
Yes. So we can hear this one early.
And will you state your name for Deanna, please?
Angela Finnegan.
Thanks. Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
Yes.
Thank you.
And then again, since we're not having to read all this through, because we're not having a typical hearing.
Right, correct. Well, this is this is an action item request for the Board of Equalization to equalize value on a set of properties where we have discovered through the appeal process or after notices of value gone out that we have a discrepancy in the value of the off-lake properties versus those on the lake that the appraiser would like to bring forward to you and request that an adjustment to those properties be made.
Okay.
So I'll let her.
Yeah, please give us the information.
So there are the cabins at Catamount. I think there's a total of 20. 10 of them are off lake, so they don't sit right on the lake. And I got 5 appeals on them. And in looking closer and...
Here's the cabins.
Yep.
Off lake. Single family. Mm-hmm. And here's the on lake cabins.
So I did get 5 of the 10 appealed, and so I looked at it closer. There were 2 good sales in there. The 10-mile model was just—it was calculating high. So going forward, I'm creating another tier of value for those in another neighborhood to just reflect they are different than the on the lake, the sales. So of the 5, I adjusted the original 2019 value was $1,418,510, and I adjusted downward to $1,190,420, which I had 2 sales in there, and the median of these 2 sales was about 1.2. And I adjusted lowered the land value from 350 to 300, as well as creating a new neighborhood code to value those. So I am asking to adjust the 5 unprotested one just to be equitable.
And so the other 5 have already been adjusted.
Yes.
This is for them.
Okay. Yes.
For the 5 that had not appealed.
And by creating the new neighborhood, it should, going forward, it should accurately reflect that.
So, again, we're talking about 5 of these 10 protested, mm-hmm. and we just want to equalize the other 5.
And you've determined that you originally had them at $350,000 each?
The land. The total, they're all very cookie cutter. They're all very similar. So the original 2019 value was $1,418,510. The 5 protested one I lowered to $1,190,420.
The 300 and 350 is the value of the
land. That's just the land.
Underneath all of them.
Each.
Yeah, basically that parcel line you're saying. So the land value is 350, she's moving that to 3. These are still at 350.
Yeah.
And then she has a neighborhood adjustment on the improvement itself that was the same for both categories, mm-hmm. correct?
It was. Now it's going to be different.
And she's wanting to create a lower neighborhood adjustment on
We have a
goes off the ledge.
Value for the land, mm-hmm. and then a value for the building on top of the land.
Mm-hmm.
That's not typically how we. I guess it is how you value property.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're required to value both the land and the improvements separately. When it comes time to protest, a commission or a petitioner can only protest the entire value, and they can't nitpick us on, well, I like my land value, but I want you to adjust it's the whole value of the property. In this case here, what we're trying to do is we have neighborhood adjustments on both land and on the improvements. There's more flexibility there and tools in the toolbox of adjusting or manipulating values. So she's just basically making a second tier mm-hmm. for the land value for off the lake versus mm-hmm. on the lake. And then this neighborhood adjustment on the improvements.
So each, you're now valuing each one of these lots with the improvements at $1,190,000?
Yes.
Each?
Yes. And I just mentioned the neighborhood and stuff because it's preferable to be able to correct it that way so that the model will just continue calculating as opposed to putting an override mm-hmm. that you have to look at every year. And so that's why I mentioned that. And then I have a list of the five accounts that would be adjusted.
Typically, there's always a water influence premium paid to be on the water versus off, so I'm kind of surprised that we didn't have this in place in the past. But, you know, given that she had 50% of those off-lake property owners protesting, she's got a couple sales,
mm-hmm,
to support that $1.2 million range. Versus, do you have on lake sales?
I didn't bring them up.
Okay.
I just brought the ones that were relevant.
All right. So
I'm satisfied.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Madam Chair, in the matter of hold on a minute here.
The numbers, right?
I got them. I've got them right here. In the matter of account numbers, R8166761, R8166762, R8166766, R8166777, and R8166779, I would move to accept the assessor's recommendations that the Board of Equalization lower the valuation of the five unprotested properties to an equitable ad valorem assessment of $1,190,420 from the original 2019 value of $1,418,510.
Second. Other discussion? All in favor?
Let's wait and see if we have something more to discuss.
Other discussion?
Well, I wanted to mention the statute that gives you that legal authority.
Okay.
I think it's in the packet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's 39A102 print 1, where the Board of Equalization shall review the valuations for assessment. It shall correct any errors made by the assessor, and whenever it is in its judgment, justice, and right so require, it shall raise, lower, or adjust any valuations for assessment appearing in the assessment roll to the end that all valuations for assessment are just and equalized within the county. So,
very good.
Again, we're just trying to kind of equalize that row of properties.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Is there something for her to sign?
Not
because she wouldn't be signing any change in if there was a protested valuation.
Well, we don't have an abatement form, and
okay, that's right.
It's
just an equalization,
and there will be a letter that's going to be sent out by your office, Helen, that will send it out to these property owners, letting them know that their value has dropped.
Okay,
great. It opens them up to an appeal process. Still. They can appeal to the BAA. In this case, we're not expecting them to appeal. No. They didn't appeal when their value was $200,000 right. higher. I suspect it will come to them as...
But their appeal would be directly to the BAA?
Yes, I believe that's the process okay. in this matter.
Because we've made a decision
yeah.
already.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
and all that's, we, Helena has sample letters. We've sent these out before. It's been a while. Sometimes we're raising the value. But yeah, there's, if they wish to appeal, it's to the State Board of Assessment Appeals.
So that Helena has that.
I guess they have options.
Take care of that.
They have all three choices. So it's very much like the normal appeal process that went started at the assessor level. They still have those three forks in the road after the second after the Board of Equalization acts. So they're just picking it up midway, I guess.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thank you.
And we have a few of these.
Okay. So we're looking at the Riverview subdivision parcels next.
All right. So this will be Kevin Krause, our commercial appraiser. He will need to be sworn in.
Yes. I'm an expert at swearing in now.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you two doing?
Good. All right, so we'll go ahead and swear in the assessor. Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
I do.
Thank you. So, all right.
Okay, I've got a problem here. Because when I don't have Riverview.
We're on this one. Downtown Riverview subdivision.
Hand that over to you.
So that is not on my agenda.
You might have the
It wasn't in their page.
I've got the one that's on the website.
Keep going down. So it is that second one right there. Downtown Riverview.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
No problem.
Okay, right, so this is another Board of Equalization adjustment request coming from the assessor's office. This recommended action we're asking for today is to also lower values on 9 vacant development parcels in the Riverview subdivision, which is a new subdivision platted in late 18?
Yes.
17.
18.
Okay. So
where am I?
It's on 3rd Street, isn't it?
Okay. This is the Nature's.
Yeah, Natural Grocers.
Natural Grocers.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay.
The old Pepe's gas station parking lot.
Yep. So okay, I'm with you.
They've been working on the infrastructure for quite a while now. Mm-hmm. So as you know or may not know, vacant land is subject to a subdivider discount or present net worth. Discounting, and this was brought to our attention by our chief appraiser in discussions with the state auditor that we had a couple numbers wrong in our calculations, and we felt it needed to be corrected, and I'll let Kevin explain that stuff.
Okay. I think the first thing you probably want to look at is this page here, the vacant land subdivision discounting worksheet. This is in Excel, and it's just a calculation worksheet that determines the very bottom line, the present worth factor that's applied to the actual value for the given year on the given property. Mm-hmm. There's two of these in here. One is the one with the errors, and then the second one, the one with the errors, the present worth factor at the bottom is 58.89%. The second one is the corrected version, where the present worth factor is 42.79%.
So did you guys have a bad formula?
No.
No, we'll just explain input. That. So to explain that, the original calculation was taken, what we came up with our estimated market value of the property and discounted it by the inverse of 58% of that market value is what was placed on the tax roll, correct?
Yes, that's right. Okay. Yep. Yep.
And after the error, that is dropping to 40.
Yeah, it's only capturing 42.79% of the.
So he'll talk about what the actual errors are.
So on the first version, the sheet with the error, if I could direct you to the second line down where it says total original buildable lots or tracts, there are actually 10 new subdivided properties that are marketable. However, only 9 of them were vacant or are vacant buildable lots. So one error that was made is that 10 should have been a 9. That's just data entry error there. And then there were no subdivisions in the downtown area of similar type properties where we could estimate the absorption period or use as a sample a reference point for how many lots sell during a given period. So at that point, it's assumed that there is one sale given or during our 24-month data collection period. And if you look at the line down, let's see, 5, the 6th line down where it says during current data gathering period, it says that there's one there that actually sold. And if what happened was that one was placed in the next line or several lines down during the data gathering period, one was used for the data collection period, but that is actually representing how many lots were to sell during a given year, not the entire period. So that's really where the big error is at. One was placed in that block. If you go to the corrected version, you can see that during the 24-month period, per year, only half a lot sells. So in applying that difference, the calculation drops from 58.89% down to 42.79%. And if I could direct you over to this other sheet that I have, it's probably better illustrated as far as what is actually going on with this sheet here, the Riverview Yampa Development LLC, another spreadsheet. In the center of that spreadsheet is the 2019 reappraisal actual value of each of the properties. You can see the first one is $2.8 million and some change. And if you go across to the right, the original present worth factor, the one with the errors, is that 0.5889. It calculated to $1.6,077,000. And then with the corrected present worth factor, it's calculating to $1.2,018,660. So that's a 27% correction. And doing that to each of the remaining 8 lots results in the total original subdivider discount value was $8,495,850. And with the correction, it drops it down to the total subdivider value of $6,173,150. So we're just asking that we make that necessary change and correction.
Seems like pretty straightforward math.
Yeah.
So the DBT or the statute requirements requires that if there's no sales, you must assume there's one, or there's an absolute minimum calculation of one, starting divided by zero. One in the collection period,
which is 24 months. Okay.
And then that was the error, because the next line is average number of lots or tracts sold per year.
Yeah.
So that should have been 0.5. And then in the intervening years, these things get reassessed again, and you simply take down the absorption period number of years down by one if you have no more sales. Is how that works, and so they get reassessed every year, and so the discount lessens a little bit in the intermediate year. The following year is the reappraisal again, and hopefully they'll have some sales, and our discounting won't be as steep because
correct.
Our absorption period will rise.
So I can make one motion stating all of the account numbers, and then stating the original subdivider discounted value and the new, or I can just state the new corrected subdivision discount value in total.
We don't need to do each account number separately. Is that the
dollar number separately?
Well, I think you need to.
I'll state all of the account numbers.
I would go one account number and what the new value.
Okay.
Is.
Okay.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, in the matter of account. In the matter of these multiple account numbers, I would move that we lower the original subdivider discount value to new corrected subdivider discount values as follows. In account number R818-0413, the corrected amount will be $1,218,660. And the matter of account number R818-0414, the corrected amount will be $452,720. Account number R818-0415, the corrected amount is $393,670. In the matter of account number R818-0416, the corrected amount is $452,720. In the matter of account number R818-0417, the corrected amount will be $452,720. Account number R818-0418, the corrected amount will be $413,350. Account number R818-0419, the corrected amount will be $452,720. Account number R818-0420, the corrected amount will be $1,332,740. Account number R818-0421, the corrected amount will be $1,003,850.
Second. Other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. The next item we will be hearing, thank you, is the valuation correction of 12 U.S. Forest Service possessory interest accounts.
Okay. This is with the land possessory interest appraiser is Matt Kukan. Matt needs to be sworn in.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give is the truth?
Raise your hand. I swear.
Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
I swear.
Thank you.
Okay, so this error in calculations was discovered by the state auditor firm. Wild Rose Appraisal is the auditor for all 64 counties and the values produced by the assessor's offices, and he brought to Matt's attention an error he had in his mathematical formula on 12 possessory interest accounts, which I will let him discuss or tell you about right now.
So typically, when you value a possessory interest account, it's based on the fee paid to the tax-exempt entity. And then a mathematical formula is used to assign a value. And with the long-term lease, it's the fee paid over the term of the lease. And the further the lease term gets, the more that value is discounted. So the mill levy, typically, it's reduced by the assessment rate, and then that's added to the capitalization rate, and it's plugged into a net present value formula. And the error that was made was that assessment rate of 29% wasn't applied to the mill levy, so it was being valued as if they were paying more taxes than they actually were, which resulted in a lower value than it should have been. So requesting the value be raised to account for the assessment rate.
So our error resulted in undervaluation. State auditor called us out on it, said we needed to correct it, and apply the effective tax rate to the discount rate factoring, and that results in an actual increase in the valuations. So we're talking about 12 different accounts, so there is a range of the value corrections on a percentage basis, 7% up to 19% increase. On a dollar figure, it's as low as $50 and as high as $14,650. Does this include the U.S. Forest Service lease with the ski resort?
No. That was done right.
So he's got a spreadsheet on those actual accounts with the percent change, and the corrected values are in pink, and the original values are in yellow.
Yeah. So I'm bridling against having to state all of these individually. I think it would be acceptable to state a motion with the... I'll just do them all.
I would just read the account numbers
and the credit amount.
Dollar amount.
You can blame Doug for not being here, so you guys can't take turns.
That's right. So, Madam Chair, I would move that we accept the assessor's recommendation that we adjust the valuation of the following possessory interest accounts as follows. And that would be...
Orange column there.
I just got to blow it up here a little bit, make it easier for me to read it. I've got it. I've got it right here. Account number R8179723. The corrected amount will be $1,860. Account number R8179895. The corrected amount will be $6,630. Account number R8179060. The corrected amount will be $4,790. Account number R8179086. The corrected amount will be $69,100. Account number R8173798. The corrected amount will be $8,630. Account number R8173260, the corrected amount will be $370. Account number R8174013, the corrected amount will be $3,110. Account number R8180577, the corrected amount will be $1,290. Account number R8179242, the corrected amount will be $111,030. Account number R8180584, the corrected amount will be $5,340. Account number R8180587, the corrected amount will be $720. Account number R8179894, the corrected amount will be $770.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you guys.
And so the final one is actually a hearing? Is that, am I?
Snowflower, we do not know if the petitioner will show up or not. This is not scheduled till 2:50, so we're going to have to wait.
Okay, no problem. Sounds good, thanks. We will do that. We'll reconvene. So we'll go ahead and swear. I'll just start at the beginning. As required by statute, the Board of County Commissioners is sitting as the County Board of Equalization. We are ready to hear the appeal for schedule number R0625911. So the first order of business is to swear in the appraiser. Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give is the truth to the best of your knowledge?
Yes.
Thank you. So I would like to make a few introductory comments regarding this proceeding. The issue of today's proceeding is property valuation and or classification for assessment purposes, not property taxes. No discussion of taxes will be allowed. The assessor's office must produce information to support the basis and amount of the assessor's valuation of the property or classification if that is what is being contested. Where the comparable sales method is used, state statute provides that the assessor will determine value based on sales during the 18-month period ending June 30th, 2018. Sales may also be considered in 6-month increments immediately preceding the 18-month period up to 5 years if there are insufficient sales to obtain accurate comparable valuation data. Smaller counties commonly use a 24-month period in order to obtain sufficient comparable sales data that better demonstrates the change in value from the prior level of value, June 30th 2016. The 24-month period also eliminates seasonality from the sales data. Route County uses a 24-month data collection period. The petitioner and the assessor should not discuss sales post June 30th, 2018, except in cases when it can be demonstrated that a contract for sale was completed prior to June 30th, 2018 and closed after June 30th, 2018, according to the original contract. Under Colorado law, the present value of your property cannot be considered. The petitioner is invited to present his or her evidence first and have the opportunity to cross-examine the representatives from the assessor's office after they have presented their evidence. Do I read these other parts right now? Yes. The decision of this board may be appealed, and we will refer to that after the decision or motion has been made. If either party has any exhibits they wish the board to consider, please give them to the secretary for marking. So I'll note that the petitioner is not present but has submitted some materials for consideration. So I will invite the assessor's office to present the information.
Okay. This property is located at Snowflower Condominiums. It's unit 212. It has 1,506 square feet, four bedrooms, four bath, garage parking. It's a corner unit. In 2013 reappraisal, it was discovered that this property had undergone significant remodeling. So a grade modifier of 25% was applied to the account. Those grade modifiers are there so that properties that are remodeled aren't being undervalued and properties that are not remodeled aren't being overvalued. So we apply those modifiers to individual accounts. So in the 2015 reappraisal, the grade modifier was adjusted to 15% just based on paired sales and the time of when those remodels had occurred. Then the grade modifier remained in place for the 2017 reappraisal and for the 2019 reappraisal. The subject was listed as of June 30th, 2018 for $695,000 or $461 a square foot. I did look at the MLS. I checked the comments, I did look at the photos, and I determined that that grade modifier of 15% was still an appropriate modifier. So it remained on the account. In the reappraisal process, in doing the values for those properties over at Snowflower, there was one sale in the subject's tier of four-bedroom units. Unit 204 had 1,434 square feet, four bedrooms, three baths. It had a remodeled kitchen, original baths, and it had an obstructed view in comparison to what the subject had. So it sold for a time-adjusted sales price of $406 a square foot. So I do have photos if you guys want to take
a look. What unit number was that?
Unit 204. That was the sale that I used to help value those units in that tier. It had a small modifier applied to it because of the remodel of the kitchen, but ultimately the time-adjusted sales price for that was $406 a square foot. There are some photos of the subject, which is the first page of photos after the plat map, and that's the subject property. You can see the condition inside, the remodel at the updated cabinets, stainless steel appliances, granite countertops, newer carpet, remodeled bathrooms, paint, fixtures, lighting. And then the third page of the photos, which is the petitioner's comparable number two, that's unit 204 Snowflower. So that's the comparable sale that I used. And you can see there was some remodeling done as well. The finishes weren't quite as high end. The bathrooms, it's hard to tell, but in the second to last photo on that first page, you can kind of see the original cabinets in there in the bathroom. So looking at this property and looking at the subject property, the subject is valued at about 10% more than this sale. And I felt like that was appropriate moving forward, so that's where the valuation sat. When the petitioner appealed, They had come in and given me three comparable sales. One was that unit 204. Another was over at the Phoenix, which has a little bit larger square footage, 1,724 square feet. And then one, the third comparable the petitioner supplied was over at Meadows Eagle Ridge, and that has 2,280 square feet. Again, I've included photos of those so you can see the interior, but there's, I didn't feel like those were as good of comparables to use. Number one, the Phoenix is a little bit further away from the ski area. There again, they have to go across a busy street to get access, where Snowflower is a little bit more user-friendly. The Meadows at Eagle Ridge are approximately 1,900 feet away from the subject, so quite a bigger distance away, and that sales price, I think, reflects the higher HOA, the larger square footage, the distance from the ski area. So I didn't feel like the comparables that the petitioner supplied were good, valid comparables. So I did stick with weighing on that unit 204, and then there again comparing the condition of that unit 204 versus the subject. I did pull some paired sales to give me an idea of the difference in condition. I didn't find any paired sales from Snowflower, but I did find sales from other condo projects. So I pulled sales from Torian, Promontory, and the ranch at Steamboat to give me an idea of what the market is recognizing for differences in condition. And I came up with an average difference of 13.84% and a median of 14.3%. There again, the subject is valued at about 10% more than unit 204, so I felt like that was an appropriate place to put that value. So I had denied the appeal at the assessor level. For CBOE, I did not receive any additional information. Again, it was the same three comparables. So I looked a little bit further to see if there was something else that I might be missing. I did look at the percent differences since the subject was listed during the reappraisal. I looked to see if there's a percent difference between list price and sale price. There is an average of 5.43% for the most recent sales at Snowflower, but using that unit 204 as it is in the subject's valuation tier, there was a list to sale price difference of 1.68%. So I ended up determining that, in my opinion, the value of $666,000 $780 or $442 a square foot is an appropriate value for this property.
So, have we seen that methodology before, the comparison of
listing price to
sales price? It's interesting.
I asked Susan about that because I had not seen it before, just my chief appraiser. And she...
She's right behind you.
Oh,
she's...
Why don't you come up here and sit up here and talk about that.
Has she been sworn in?
Yes, I'll remind Susan. I'll remind the representative from the assessor's office that she's still under oath.
I have used that, I believe, in prior reappraisal reports. I just think that there's a relationship between the list price and a subsequent sales price. We're not looking at the sale after the time period. We're just looking at the list price as of our appraisal date. And if you get an independent fee appraisal, you'll see that they analyze that as well. It's just market data as of our, within our time frame.
No, I'm not disputing it. It's interesting to me. I just don't recall seeing it before, and I think it has some validity because it is based upon actual sales.
As a double check reconciliation on our test of reasonableness, on our values.
And to speak to Susan's point, I think it was appropriate in this because this property did go under contract 2 days after the time period. So there was sort of this, Susan had mentioned to me, well, why don't you look at the difference in that percentage and see, because it was so close at the end of the time period that where it went under contract.
So I would like to point out the difference between, the best comp here is comp one, the unit 204.
Yes.
In the Snowflower, very similar square footage, same bedroom and bath count, I believe.
Yes.
This is, but your observation was that the remodel was of a lower value in this 204.
In unit 204, okay. Yeah. And I do have those photos, and you can see, yep. You can see the difference in there.
Okay. Well, I can't really see the difference because they're real estate photos, and so they did a really good job not capturing those cabinets in the bathroom.
So this is the plat sheet on the Snowflower, and this is our subject. Here, it is an end unit. It's facing to the west, I'll show you an aerial in a moment. And then this is it's comp number two. Petitioner's comp number two, facing east. So it's staring at the mountain. But I want to show you that the aerial view of that. So again, the subject here is overlooking. This is all grass area with the pool and stuff. Used to be a tennis court. They filled that in. Now it's grass and a fire pit. And they get to look South Valley. And you do see that in the MLS pictures from the living room. You kind of see a distant view out the window. Here is that comp number two. Is this structure right here to the right of the driveway. And there's two big pine trees right in front of their window. So they really don't get to see the mountain. And you can see that in the photos in that MLS photos that they show. So this is the subject photos.
Yes.
And I'm going to blow this up for you. And you can see kind of the top two pictures to the right, looking out the windows, you're seeing that. And you get good pictures of the level of nice finishes on that remodel. The granite in the look at the bathroom, new plumbing in the shower, new countertops, cabinets, new doors, molding and stuff. And then when you get to, there's the Phoenix. The Phoenix is a comparable location. They do have to walk across the busy street, as Robin said. But they can get to the ski resort in about the same amount of walk. So this is that unit 204 in the Snowflower. And those two pictures, you're seeing them looking out their window. And
the deck there as well.
And the deck, and they get to see the mountain, but there's a whole lot of pine trees in front of them, and they would have to petition their HOA to get those sold. But, there's the bathroom picture. We're talking original bathroom. But on top of the finishes of the subject or the complete remodel, I think we also have a little bit of location superiority in the subject, being that end unit looking out west versus an interior unit that really doesn't get the views you might expect it to get. That's what I wanted to add.
Well, I'm persuaded that the original valuation was correct. The evidence presented by the appraiser is convincing that they've got the number right. So,
yes.
Madam Chair, I would move in the matter of.
I don't have the number in.
Account number R0625911 to deny the petitioner's valuation with the finding that the assessor has provided sufficient information to support the basis and amount of the valuation at $666,780.
Second. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And then I'll state that the decision of this board may be appealed to the Route County District Court, the State Board of Assessment Appeals, or through an arbitration process. The petitioner will be sent a letter informing them of the board's decision and their rights concerning the appeal process. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have to sign something?
1985. 86.
Does it come back to me later?
Snowflower?
You know what? I can tell you. I have it.
Probably in the MLS.
85.
Yep. It was one of my first drywall projects.
Maybe it was that unit.
I like
some so very unpleasant memories coming out of there.
Unpleasant memories.
Real, that was a real money loser, that one.
Do I sign something?
Or no, I don't believe so.
No?
Okay. So the...
If it is, it can come back to me when it needs to.
Helena sends out a letter of the decision or the denial to the petitioner, tells them their appeal rights, and
I feel like
it's abatement, so you end up signing.
Oh, okay,
great.
All right,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
we'll see you next week.
I think we're done till Monday.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, we have one more item after you, so
good.
So Tina Fry, and I'm the Chief Deputy Clerk and Recorder.
Thank you. And then we're hearing a supplemental budget request for elections equipment. Go ahead.
And first, I want to apologize that Kim is not here for this, as you guys are probably realizing, and we know that elections is definitely an ever-changing, ever-growing beast, and the Dominion, who is a statewide election equipment for most of the counties and stuff, is doing a huge upgrade, and they just got recertification from the state of Secretary of State's office. And so Kim and my two elections coordinators are in Montrose this week doing training on all ballot handling, and then they're going to have to be in Grand Junction next week for all the ballot programming and stuff. So,
she's not here
regarding this and has asked me to come up for this. And
she gave us a little background information.
Lovely. Yeah, she said she did, and the information and going through the supplemental budget. And I do know also that she did meet with Dan Strnad, and I know Dan worked a lot with her on this. They were in office together going over all of the
so we already approved the purchase. We're just approving the supplemental budget to support that purchase.
That is my understanding.
Is that that doesn't sound correct. I don't think so.
We're approving the supplemental budget.
I don't think we have to approve the purchase. We just have to approve the supplemental budget.
Yeah.
But we indicated to Kim that we were willing to
support. Yeah, I think she explained that we're
but
extremely...
But we have to officially approve the purchase itself, just the budget.
It's very exciting. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. So she explained to us the need, and we told her that we were supportive of her doing that.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay.
So I'm ready to make a motion.
Sounds good to me. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve the supplemental budget request for the Elections Division of the County Clerk and Recorder's Office in the amount of $64,300 to purchase a ballot scanning machine and ballot printer.
Second.
Discussion. Can I see that for a moment, please? The actual.
And let me also give you the. That's you can keep those extra copies on there.
So we go through this process with Dan that we went through previously for the 2018 supplemental budgets, and there's a different form that Dan reads off for the approval of each one.
There's a resolution.
So I'm going to make the assumption that we'll actually see a supplemental budget resolution.
That's a good question.
To support
this. We should check in.
And I think that's fine. I think that's one of the things that we'd like to do a better job of.
Okay.
I really appreciate you guys in the clerk's office bringing forward an actual supplemental budget for our approval rather than waiting until the end of the year. I suspect that we'll still have a resolution that we need to do.
Yes, and I know Kim's been checking her emails, so on my end also. She did, and so I can also email. I want to get back down there to confirm that together her and Dan are coming up with some resolution for you guys or something like that.
What we really should be doing is approving a supplemental budget resolution.
Okay.
But I think this is
a
good faith effort that we'll follow up.
Okay, that sounds great. Like I said, I'll follow up with an email with her that you'll be looking for a resolution.
Yep.
Maybe her and Dan can get together and put together for you guys.
So. And maybe Dan's already got a plan.
He could be, yeah.
Just find out when that's on the agenda.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good. Any other discussion? All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thanks so much.
Thank you for making it easy.
But I believe I do need to sign.